couple of weeks ago, we started a series on the temptations of Christ, and we talked about the first temptation the last time. And today we're going to focus on the second one. And I would like for us again to look at Luke chapter 4. And we're going to focus on verses 5 through 8. And he led him up and showed him all the kingdoms of the world in a moment of time. And the devil said to him, I will give you all this domain and its glory, for it has been handed over to me, and I give it to whomever I wish. Therefore, if you worship me before me, it shall all be yours. Jesus answered him, it is written, you shall worship the Lord your God and serve him only. Satan offered to give Jesus his kingdom. Well, we are told in the scriptures that everyone who sins is in the kingdom of Satan. They belong to Satan. If you take a look at 1 John chapter 3, 1 John chapter 3, and starting at verse 7, 1 John 3, and starting at verse 7, it says, little children, make sure no one deceives you. The one who practices righteousness is righteous, just as he is righteous. The one who practices sin is of the devil, for the devil has sinned from the beginning. The Son of God appeared for this purpose, to destroy the works of the devil. No one who is born of God practices sin, because the seed abides in him, and he cannot sin because he is born of God. By this, the children of God and the children of the devil are obvious. Anyone who does not practice righteousness is not of God, nor the one who does not love his brother. And so Jesus charges and says that Satan is the ruler of this world because this world is given over to sin. In John chapter 12, John chapter 12 and in verse 31, now judgment is upon this world. Now the ruler of this world will be cast out. And he's referring to Satan there. In essence, and actually let's read verse 32 as well. And if I am lifted up, I will draw all men to myself. Jesus' purpose was to pull people to him. No longer following Satan, but following God. In essence, Satan was offering to fold without a fight. If Jesus would just give up and worship Satan, Satan says, I won't fight you for this. I'll just give it to you. Now, if you think about what Satan asked of Jesus, it wouldn't hurt anyone. At least not on the surface. You know, that's what a lot of people teach. A lot of people believe this. That as long as no one is hurt, well, then it can't be wrong. And this is the way people justify pornography, fornication, and basically any other sin where everybody who's involved consent to that sin. It's even extended so that if there's no severe consequences, well, then it's not a big deal. Premarital sex is seen as fine as long as one can practice safe sex. As long as disease and pregnancy are avoided, well, then there's no harm and it's not a bad thing in people's mind. And this way, sins are then defended. For example, I've heard people say, well, if one has a drink in his own home, well, then no one's harmed. It's not as if he's not taking care of his family. He's not on the highway jeopardizing lives. Or years ago, we had I think it was Secretary of State, Bill Bennett. He was defended for his gambling habits. Because, well, while it was large sums, it wasn't money needed by his family because they were wealthy. So that's no problem. The core of all these arguments is that the things that we might call sin are really not sin if they don't harm anybody else. And that could be argued here. Worshipping Satan is wrong. But it was just Jesus. No one else was involved. No one else would have been hurt. And so in a lot of people's minds, well, how could that be a sin? The flaw is that sin is wrong because it always contains harm. Take a look at 1 Corinthians chapter 6. 1 Corinthians chapter 6 and in verse 18. Flee immorality. Every other sin that a man commits is outside the body, but the immoral man sins against his own body. Or do you not know that your body is the temple of the Holy Spirit who is in you, whom you have from God, and you are not your own? You have been bought with a price, therefore glorify God in your body. Now there's another argument that's sometimes made. And that is basically to say, well, everybody does it. Many people judge right or wrong based on this general acceptance in society. It can't be wrong, all that wrong, if others are involved in the same thing. I had a discussion with a young man just last night. His mother wanted me to talk to him about modest clothing because they were out at a park and there were people swimming that weren't very modestly dressed. And she said, we're going someplace else. She wanted me to explain that to him. But it's that basic idea. Well, other people are doing it. Not that this young man was making that argument, but that's the basic problem that's argued. And hence, even when political figures are found in sin, you'll find a rash of articles about how others have done similar things. I remember when Bill Clinton was caught lying, and the papers were filled with articles about how every politician lies. You expect politicians to lie, so therefore what he did wasn't not that bad. Ever try to talk to today's teens about the immorality of premarital sex? Now, I talk to quite a few nowadays. And oftentimes the question is not whether to do it or not, but they want to know when would be a good time to do it. And with whom? It's not a question in the society at large. We got to realize this. Around us, it's accepted as just what everybody does. You know, we talk about divorce being wrong. And even Christians readily consider divorce because, well, in society, it doesn't can't carry any stigma. And so people think, well, yes, that's an option. Improper attire is accepted on the beach, like we mentioned, or in the swimming pool, because, well, everybody else dresses that way. Yet the majority simply indicates that that is the easy path. Kind of like what Satan was offering Jesus, the easy path. Take a look at Matthew chapter 7. Matthew chapter 7. And in verse 13, enter through the narrow gate, for the gate is wide and the way is broad that leads to destruction. And there are many who enter through it. For the gate is small and the way is narrow that leads to life, and there are few who find it. Now, another way that people will sometimes try to argue about their sins is to say, well, no one needs to know. Now remember, Jesus was taken up by Satan to a high mountain. Not too many people living up on top of high mountains. Or if you take a look at Matthew chapter 4, and in verse 8, the parallel of this, the account we read earlier. Again, the devil took him to a very high mountain and showed him all the kingdoms of the world and their glory. You know, many of the sins that are done in the world are done under the cover of darkness, so that no one else knows who's doing them. And Paul points this out in 1 Thessalonians. 1 Thessalonians chapter 5. And in verse 4, but you, brethren, are not in the darkness that the day would overtake you like a thief. For you are all sons of light and sons of day. We are not of dark night nor of darkness. So then, let us not sleep as others do, but let us be alert and sober. For those who sleep do their sleeping at night, and those who get drunk at night. But since we are of the day, let us be sober, having put on the breastplate of faith and love, and as a helmet, the hope of salvation. You know, once sins are committed, people try to hide the fact that they sinned. You know, David, back in the Old Testament, he committed adultery. What did he do? He tried to hide his sin by making it look like it didn't happen. He tried to get the husband to have sex with his wife so it didn't look like it happened. He lied about it. He eventually committed murder, trying to cover up this sin. But Solomon points out that hiding sins just make things worse. Take a look at Proverbs chapter 28 and in verse 13. He who conceals his transgression will not prosper, but he who confesses and forsakes them will find compassion. See, the problem is that while people are hiding things from each other, they forget that God sees everything. Nothing is hidden from him. In Proverbs 15, look at verse 3. Proverbs 15, verse 3. The eyes of the Lord are in every place, watching the evil and the good. You think no one's watching, but God's seeing everything. And we have to give an account to God for the things that we do, because God's not going to let us get by with anything in our life. In Hebrews chapter 4 and verse 13, there is no creature hidden from his sight, but all things are open and laid bare to the eyes of him whom we have to do. And there's just no hiding from God. In fact, that's one of the Psalms, Psalms 139. Psalms 139 is about the fact that God sees everything. O Lord, you have searched me and known me. You know when I sit down and when I rise up. You understand my thought from afar. You scrutinize my path and my lying down, and are intimately acquainted with all my ways. Even before there is a word on my tongue, behold, O Lord, you know it all. You have enclosed me behind and before, and laid your hand upon me. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me. It's too high. I cannot attain it. Where can I go from your spirit? Or where can I flee from your presence? If I ascend to heaven, you are there. If I make my bed in Sheol, behold, you are there. If I take the wings of the dawn, and if I dwell in the remotest part of the sea, even there your hand will lead me, and your right hand will lay hold of me. If I say, surely the darkness will overwhelm me, and the light around me will be as night, even the darkness is not dark to you, and the night is as bright as the day. Darkness and light are alike to you. For you formed my inward parts, you wove me in my mother's womb. I will give thanks to you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Wonderful are your works, and my soul knows it very well. My frame was not hidden from you when I was made in secret and skillfully wrought in the depths of the earth. Your eyes have seen my unformed substance, and in your book were all written, the days that were ordained for me, even as yet when none, there were none of them. How precious also are your thoughts to me, O God. How vast the sum of them. If I should count them, they would outnumber the sand. When I awake, I am still with you. Oh, that you would slay the wicked, O God. Depart from me, therefore, men of bloodshed. For they speak against you wickedly, and your enemies take your name in vain. Do I not hate those who hate you, O Lord? And do I not loathe those who rise up against you? I hate them with the uttermost hatred. They have become my enemies. Search me, O God, and know my heart. Try me, and know my anxious thoughts. And see if there's any hurtful way in me, and lead me in the everlasting way. But you know, we talk about hiding things. There's one thing that we can't hide. I can't hide from myself. Take a look at Romans chapter 2. Romans chapter 2 and in verse 15. In that they show the work of the law written in their hearts, their conscience bearing witness, and their thoughts alternatively accusing or else defending them. I know what I've done. And our hearts can condemn us. We do have a conscience, and it does bother people at times. Take a look at 1 John. 1 John chapter 3. 1 John chapter 3 and starting at verse 20. In whatever our hearts condemns us, for God is greater than our hearts and knows all things. But, beloved, if our heart does not condemn us, we have confidence before God. We need a good testimony from our own conscience. As Paul said in 2 Corinthians chapter 1 and in verse 12. 1 Corinthians chapter 1 verse 12. For our proud confidence is this, the testimony of our conscience, that in the holiness and godly sincerity, not in fleshly wisdom, but in the grace of God, we have conducted ourselves in the world and especially towards you. Paul had a good conscience. He had nothing to fear going before God. And it didn't bother him day and night. Another way people justify their sins is, well, it's only going to be just one time. It's just one fling. It's just one drink. Just one drug. The danger before marriage is oftentimes committing fornication because, well, we're going to get married anyway. The true danger is when sin is committed and the consequences are minimized. Because you'll hear people say, well, no harm was done. What they're really saying is, I got away with it. Or they'll say, it was only a little thing. What they mean is that, well, I can handle it. It's not like I do it all the time. I think I still can resist. Sin leads to death because of its searing power, numbs us to the consequences. Take a look at the warning that's in 1 Timothy chapter 4. And I'm starting at verse 1. It says, but the Spirit explicitly says that in latter times, some will fall away from the faith, paying attention to deceitful spirits and doctrines of demons, by means of the hypocrisy of liars, seared in their own conscience as with a branding iron. Men who forbid marriage and advocate abstaining from foods which God had created to be gratefully shared in by those who believe and know the truth. People can get numb to what's wrong. Or in Ephesians chapter 4. Ephesians chapter 4 and starting at verse 7. Or 17. Ephesians chapter 4 and verse 17. So this I say and affirm together with the Lord, that you walk no longer just as the Gentiles also walk, in the futility of their mind, being darkened in their understanding, excluded from the life of God, because of the ignorance that is in them, because of the hardness of their heart. They, having become calloused, having given themselves over to sensuality for the practice of every kind of impurity with greediness. But you did not learn Christ in this way. Gentiles follow after the world. They get numb to it. It doesn't bother them. And then we got people who will justify sin by saying, well, some good can come of it. You know, Jesus could rule over Satan's kingdom and avoid the cross. That's a good thing, isn't it? There's a concept that's batted around called situation ethics. It's the idea that something that is wrong could be right depending on the situation. Joseph Fletcher, in his book, Situation Ethics, The New Morality, tells of a woman in a Nazi labor camp. The Germans had a rule that pregnant women could be released from the labor camps. Thus, a woman seduced a German guard, got pregnant, was sent home, and everyone in her family was happy. And that's why they justify, well, saying that, see, that's a good thing. People argue for church-sponsored meals. Because look at how many people come and hear the gospel. They pool money cooperatively and argue the same way. Look at how many people will be reached and converted. Now, there's a story in the Old Testament about David wanting to bring the ark into Jerusalem. That's a good thing, right? And so he put it on a cart, even though that violated God's law. And take a look at 2 Samuel chapter 6. 2 Samuel chapter 6. And starting at verse 1. Now David again gathered all the chosen men of Israel, 30,000. And David arose and went with all the people who were with him to Baal, Judah, to bring up from there the ark of God, which is called by the name, the very name of the Lord of hosts, who is enthroned above the cherubim. They placed the ark of God on a new cart, that they might bring it from the house of Abinadab, which was on the hill, and Uzzah and Ahio, the sons of Abinadab, were leading the new cart. And so they brought it with the ark of God from the house of Abinadab, which was on the hill, and Ahio was walking ahead of the cart. Meanwhile, David and all the house of Israel were celebrating before the Lord with all kinds of instruments made of fir wood and lyres and harps, tambourines, castanets, and cymbals. But when they came to the threshing floor of Nacon, Ahijah reached out toward the ark of God and took hold of it, for the oxen nearly upset it. And the anger of the Lord burned against Uzzah, and God struck him down for his irreverence. And he died there by the ark of God. David became angry because of the Lord's outburst against Uzzah. And that place is called Perez Uzzah to this day. So David was afraid of the Lord that day. And he said, how can the ark of the Lord come to me? And David was unwilling to move the ark of the Lord into the city of David with him. But David took it aside to the house of Obed-Edom the Gittite. He wanted to do something good. He thought he was celebrating God. They were giving everything. Other than they weren't doing it the way God told them to do it. And it caused someone to lose their life. The problem is that doing wrong is always wrong. When you have to choose, sometimes people say, well, I need to choose the lesser of two evils. Well, the lesser is still evil. all of this is what Satan was offering Christ. And that's why Jesus responded, if we go back to Luke chapter 4, and in verse 8. Luke chapter 4, verse 8. Jesus answered him, "It is written, you shall worship the Lord your God and serve him only." It doesn't matter all the benefits you might imagine that comes, or that no one will know, that no one will see. It's only Jesus doing this. None of that matters. God said, worship him only. Peter tells us we have to resist Satan in 1 Peter chapter 5. 1 Peter chapter 5, starting at verse 8. "Be of sober spirit, be on the alert. Your adversary, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion, seeking someone to devour. But resist him, firm in your faith, knowing that the same experiences of suffering are being accomplished by your brethren who are in the world." We don't give in to Satan and think we're going to win. We have to battle him. James tells us much the same in James chapter 4 and in verse 7. "Submit therefore to God, resist the devil, and he will flee from you." Hope you'll think about these things today. We're going to cover the next time I have an opportunity to speak. Or in the morning, which will be in 2 weeks. We'll cover the third temptation, Lord willing, and finish off this series. But I hope it gets you to think and see that the Bible says that Jesus was tempted in every way like we are. No, he did not face the same temptations we did. But they're all justified and practiced the same way. They're the same type of things that we struggle with. And if there's anyone here who wishes to become a child of God, there's no better time than now to do so. And those of you who are children of God, if you would like the prayers of your brethren on behalf, why don't you come forward as we stand and sing the song that was selected.